So if you have a Bible, turn with me again, please, to the second of our readings this morning, Matthew chapter 2 and verses 1 to 12. Now we can't say for sure how old Jesus is here in this passage in Matthew 2. I guess as serious Christians we often scorn that stereotypical nativity scene in which the visit of the Magi coincides with the visit of the shepherds when Jesus has just been born. That scorn, I suppose, is based on Herod's calculations later on in the chapter and on the assumption that the Magi only saw the star in the east once Jesus had actually been born, and so only began their journey at that point. That's possible, but it's unprovable. And so it may be that Jesus is a few months old here, as we tend to think generally, or it may be that he is only still a newborn infant. But either way, he's still very young, of course. And it's fascinating, actually, to think, isn't it, that Jesus would have had no memory of this occasion in his life. This would have been for him one of those stories that he often heard as a boy. We all have them, don't we? Stories that we've heard our parents, our older siblings tell us about notable family events that occurred when we were just babies or toddlers or whatever. And doubtless it was like that for Jesus with this. At many a bedtime in that carpenter's house in Nazareth, Jesus would have lain there, his eyes wide open, listening in rapt attention as Joseph and Mary recounted the day that the Magi visited. And it's that visit then that we're considering for a short while this morning, and I just want to say three main things about it. First of all, this morning, it's a real visit. It's a real visit. Kevin DeYoung is an American Presbyterian minister, and giving a talk recently on mistakes I have made in the ministry, he mentioned how early on in his first pastorate he began to preach through the book of Ephesians, and he devoted most of the first sermon to providing arguments why Paul is the author of the book of Ephesians. And throughout the sermon then, the congregation just sat there kind of looking at him blankly. I mean, the text says that it's written by the Apostle Paul. None of them had ever once doubted that it was written by the Apostle Paul. So it might have been an appropriate sermon for a congregation of liberal New Testament critics who always like to contest claims of authorship that they find in New Testament letters. But it wasn't a particularly appropriate sermon for that orthodox Bible-believing congregation. And I suppose on the face of things, the same might be said for my first heading. This morning then, the visit of the Magi is a real visit. Well, come on, Dan, you might be thinking. I mean, this isn't an apologetics talk to university students or something who are skeptical about these kinds of things. This is a Sunday morning sermon in a Reformed evangelical church. We don't need to stress the reality of the Magi's visits. But I think there's an important difference between Paul's authorship of Ephesians on the one hand and the visit of the Magi on the other. I mean, there's nothing intrinsically improbable about Paul writing Ephesians. It's not a particularly difficult thing to believe that he picked up his pen and wrote that letter. This narrative, on the other hand, in Matthew 2, there are certain elements in it, are there not, which we might think are intrinsically improbable, which are a little difficult to believe, which might make us wonder whether there's at least a touch of myth about the whole thing. And that's a serious issue. Because if Matthew can't be trusted as a straightforward reporter of the facts in chapter 2 of his gospel, then neither can he be trusted as a straightforward reporter of the facts in chapter 28 of his gospel, when it's not the visit of some Eastern Magi that's at stake, but the very resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, and by extension, therefore, the very gospel itself. So this is important. It's important that we don't concede any ground whatsoever to that idea that might, as I say, pop up in our minds, well, perhaps some of these details have a bit of myth mixed up in them. I suppose there are two details in particular that we might wonder about here. So first of all, how these magi would have any concept of the King of the Jews. We might wonder that. I mean, whatever it was that they saw in the sky, and we'll come to that, it can't have been a theological treatise about Israel's Messiah. That can't have appeared in the sky. And so they would have had to have a messianic awareness, therefore, already from some other source, so that when they saw whatever it was they saw in the sky, they connected it to this idea that they already possessed of a Jewish Messiah. But how could they have already possessed a messianic awareness? I mean, Simeon in the Jerusalem temple, we can understand him waiting for a Jewish Messiah, Anna likewise. But these guys in some distant place where paganism prevails, is that not just a little bit far-fetched? Well, no, actually, I don't think it is far-fetched. For almost 6 centuries, ever since the Babylonian exile, there had been a significant Jewish presence and influence in the East. And those diaspora Jews, as we call them, they hadn't necessarily become paganized there in the East. I mean, you only have to think of someone like Mordecai, don't you, whom we encounter in the book of Esther. And he, of course, is very settled there in Persia. He's a royal official, it seems, in the service of Emperor Xerxes. But for all that, his theological convictions are still markedly Jewish, and they run very deep. You remember his words to Esther at that point when the annihilation of the Jews at the hands of Haman seems inevitable, and how he says to her, look, if you as queen don't save the Jews, then deliverance will arise from another place. He's quite clear on that. He's convinced of the indestructibleness of Yahweh's people, presumably because he's convinced that a Messiah must one day emerge from Yahweh's people. And so I'm saying then that an expectation of a Jewish Messiah would have been alive and well in parts of the East. Indeed, it's possible, is it not, that it was present even in written form in some of the great libraries of the Eastern world. Hadn't Daniel, for instance, been a leading intellectual in the Babylonian Empire? Daniel, a man who himself prophesied of a coming Messiah. It's not that difficult to imagine his writings, for instance, being preserved and subjected to scrutiny and scholarly investigation long after his lifetime. So no, the idea of Eastern magi having a messianic awareness, it's not far-fetched. It's a perfectly reasonable supposition. But then, I suppose, a detail which might suggest an element of myth even more is the role that this star plays in the narrative. And particularly, I suppose, that sentence in verse 9. Behold, the star that they had seen when it rose went before them until it came to rest over the place where the child was. I mean, haven't we descended there into farce? Isn't that just laughable, what Matthew is telling us? Well, as depicted on the front of Christmas cards, yes, that is fairly laughable. But once we get away from the Christmas card depiction and clarify one simple point, I think it becomes a bit less silly. And the simple point then is this. The Magi were not being guided by the star. The Magi were not being guided by the star. Now, okay, there were no sat-navs at that point in history, but there were maps and there were roads, and people were perfectly good at traveling from one place to another without the need of guiding stars. These Magi, they set off from the east looking for the King of the Jews. They would have had a perfectly good idea how to get to the Jewish capital, Jerusalem. And then once, of course, in Jerusalem, they had those discussions with Herod. They found out that Bethlehem was where they needed to go. Bethlehem was only 5 or 6 miles from Jerusalem. They'd have been given clear directions by Herod how to get there. And then, of course, once they arrived in Bethlehem, Bethlehem was no metropolis. It was the little town of Bethlehem. They wouldn't have had any more difficulty with a little bit of investigation finding Jesus than the shepherds did when they were led to Bethlehem also. And once we've clarified that then, that they were not being guided by this star, we no longer need to think of this star kind of hovering bizarrely over one particular house in Bethlehem. I mean, Matthew simply says, doesn't he, that the star came to rest over the place where the child was. That is, over the general vicinity of Bethlehem. They didn't need to be pinpointed a particular house. They would have found the house in Bethlehem. In other words, I'm saying these magi, they found Jesus by normal means, not by following yonder star. And the point in verses 9 and 10 then is that while they are there in Bethlehem, the star which had triggered their journey in the first place appears to be stationary in the sky above their heads, and they take that as a confirmation then that their journey has been worthwhile, and that's why they rejoice with exceedingly great joy. And once then we have clarified all of that and we're thinking along those lines, I don't think it's inconceivable that there is a reasonable astronomical explanation that fits what Matthew describes here. I wouldn't die for it, but Michael Molnar's theory, I think, is reasonably plausible, namely that this star was in fact a planet. It was the planet Jupiter, which had astrological connections with royalty. As Jupiter orbits around the sun, it disappears from Earth's view for several months and then reappears. The star rising in the east, as Matthew puts it here, or as the Magi put it here, might well have been such a reappearance of Jupiter after several months when it wasn't visible. And if then Jupiter on this occasion reappeared in close proximity to the constellation Aries, which had astrological connections with Judea, then the Magi might well have thought, aha, a royal star suddenly appearing in Judea's constellation, the King of the Jews. Following its reappearance, Jupiter would then have moved in a westward direction. When, however, Earth, which orbits the sun more quickly, as it were, laps Jupiter, the planet from our perspective changes direction. It would have started to move back eastward. But briefly in between that westward movement and that eastward movement, it would have appeared to be stationary. And that could well have coincided then with the Magi's arrival in Bethlehem. Now, that explanation might make you feel uneasy because of those astrological connections I mentioned. Am I saying then that, is Matthew saying that astrology is a perfectly good discipline and that there's some kind of objective validity in those connections, Jupiter and Aries and all the rest of it? Well, no, Matthew's not saying that. But what he surely is saying is that God is an amazing communicator. God is an amazing communicator. And if he wants a bunch of Eastern astrologers, and that's what these men are, they're not wise men. In fact, in biblical terms, quite the opposite. They are men who are into magic and astrology, which, by the way, is another reason Matthew's unlikely to be making this up. If he's going to make up visitors coming from all that way, he's going to make up rather better kind of visitors than these, not these disreputable astrologers and magicians. But if God wants a bunch of Eastern astrologers to come and visit his Messiah, he can, as it were, speak their language. He can even adapt to the astrological categories that they are familiar with and communicate to them in that way, arranging for his Messiah's birth to coincide with a sequence of astronomical events that they will interpret in messianic terms. God is an amazing communicator. Well, we must move on, but I hope you can see then that we don't need to reach out for the M word, myth. when we come to this narrative in Matthew 2. If we do, as I say, it's a dangerous route to go down. Because where will that stop? No, we can be sure of Matthew's factual reportage here, and sure, therefore, of his factual reportage everywhere, and not least when he reaches the great climax of his gospel. This visit of the Magi is a real visit. But then secondly this morning, it's a relevant visit. It's a relevant visit. What I mean is then, Matthew isn't just reporting this because it's real. I mean, there are lots of real things that Matthew omits from his nativity narrative. I mean, he doesn't tell us how Jesus slept in those first weeks and months as an infant. He doesn't tell us the sort of sized baby that he was, or how the weaning process went, or any of that kind of stuff. But he does tell us that Eastern Magi visited Jesus. So presumably the reason that that's included when other things aren't included is that that is relevant to what Matthew is trying to get across to us at this stage in his gospel. What is Matthew trying to get across to us at this stage in his gospel? Well, I suppose the most basic thing he's trying to get across, we've seen already, is encapsulated in four words in his opening verse. The Son of David. The Son of David. He wants to get across to us that Jesus is that. He's the Son of David. That is the special Son of David, promised first of all to David himself and then to Israel subsequently. And presumably he includes then the visit of the Magi because it's relevant to that emphasis he's wanting to make, that Jesus is the Son of David. How is it relevant to that? Well, the key to understanding that is the psalm I read earlier on this morning, Psalm 72. Now, Psalm 72 is an interesting psalm because according to the title, it relates to Solomon, who of course is David's royal son. But as you read Psalm 72, you inevitably start to think that however great King Solomon might have been, he wasn't this great. Both the chronological and the geographical dimensions here in this psalm are just too vast. Verse 5, may they fear you, that is you, the king, while the sun endures, as long as the moon, the writer says. Verse 7, in his days may the righteous flourish and peace abound till the moon be no more. Verse 8, may he have dominion from sea to sea and from the river to the ends of the earth. And you start to realize then that this psalm must relate not simply to David's immediate royal son, but to David's ultimate royal son, the messianic son. And one detail then that's emphasized in Psalm 72 is this: gifts being brought to the royal son from afar. So verse 10 talks about gifts being brought from Sheba and Seba, and then verse 15 again, gold of Sheba being brought. And surely then this is why Matthew finds the visit of the Magi so relevant. It confirms that Jesus is indeed this ultimate royal son of David's, the one depicted in Psalm 72, who receives costly treasures from distant lands. Yes, the genealogy has demonstrated that Jesus is the messianic king. Yes, the angelic announcement to Joseph in the dream that he will save his people from their sins has confirmed that he is the messianic king. And here now Matthew is adding to that testimony these Eastern Magi traveling from afar and laying at Jesus' feet their gold and their frankincense and their myrrh. But I think we can go a bit further than that, because it's interesting there in Psalm 72, this bringing gifts to the royal son from afar, it's not some random, unintelligible action. Let me show you what I mean. So in verse 10, of Psalm 72, we read of these foreign gifts being brought. And then verse 11 continues, in a similar vein, may all kings fall down before him, all nations serve him. And then verse 12 begins with the crucial word, for. In other words, the psalmist is now going to give the reasons why these gifts will be brought from afar to this son of David. What's the reason? For he delivers the needy when he calls, the poor and him who has no helper. He has pity on the weak and needy. He saves the lives of the needy. From oppression and violence, he redeems their life, and precious is their blood in his sight. This beautiful description of the character and the reign of this king. In other words, these foreigners will bring these gifts to this son of David, not out of mere etiquette, kind of following the conventions of political diplomacy or something, but rather because they are profoundly attracted to his reign and the kind of rule which he exercises. It's because they want to be under this king. In the language of verse 17, they want to be blessed in him. They want to be his subjects. And Matthew then is interested in the visit of these magi, yes, because it confirms that Jesus is the royal son of David, but also because it expresses this truth that foreigners, people from way outside Jewish circles, are going to be drawn to King Jesus. Remember, he's hinted that already by emphasizing the foreigners who are included in his genealogy. And this visit now of the Magi expands on that same idea. And I think this is an important point for us this morning. I mean, we Christians in 21st century Britain, we can all too easily develop a siege mentality, can't we? Whereby whenever we meet, we kind of look at each other sadly and shake our heads and mutter gravely about it's a day of small things that we're living in. We can easily come to Matthew chapter 2 and kind of reinforce that outlook in ourselves by focusing exclusively on Herod, whose antagonism to Jesus is so pronounced. Ah, yes, we shouldn't really expect the gospel to advance and the church to grow in this world of Herod's, we say to ourselves. And yes, Herod's presence in this passage is a solemn one, and we'll come to him in a moment. And yes, Herod's furious opposition to Jesus does live on, and it always will live on. But whatever Matthew is teaching us about these last days through that character Herod, he's teaching us something about these last days through these characters, the Magi as well. He's teaching us that these last days are not days of small things. They are days when, on the contrary, great journeys will be made by people of all kinds of unlikely backgrounds. Great journeys to come to King Jesus. Not physical journeys like the journey of these Magi, but journeys out of Islam and journeys out of Hinduism and journeys out of Buddhism and journeys out of traditional tribal religions and journeys out of polytheism and pantheism and atheism. That's the age we're now living in, Matthew is saying to us. An age of myriad men and women and boys and girls from north and south and east and west journeying to King Jesus. And we need to understand that. We need to understand it from the scriptures, and we need to understand it from opening our eyes and seeing that while, yes, it's deeply sad what's happening in our own little land today, there's a big wide world out there beyond our own little land. And in many parts of that big wide world, the scenes of Psalm 72 are being realized. And great numbers of Iranians and Chinese and Brazilians and Afghans and Algerians and Nepalese and Koreans are following in the footsteps of these pioneering magi and going to King Jesus. It's thrilling, and we mustn't allow despondency then and pessimism to set in. We mustn't come away from this passage in Matthew 2 with the solitary thought we're to expect vicious rulers who will shed blood in their raging opposition to Jesus Christ. We must also come away thinking we are to expect the people of the nations to gravitate to King Jesus and find him attractive and want to come under his rule and to journey out of their native beliefs and allegiances and idolatries to him to be his worshipping subjects. The last days, not days of small things, but days inaugurated by this journey of a bunch of men from the Far East for one reason: to fall at the feet of Jesus Christ in worship. So it's a real visit, it's a relevant visit, but then thirdly and finally this morning, it's a revealing visit. It's a revealing visit. Well, we must, as we close, of course, touch on this character Herod, who is very much there in our passage. And when I say then that the visit of the Magi is a revealing visit, what I mean is it reveals Herod, doesn't it? It reveals just how jealously possessive Herod is of his own status and his own position and his own control. Of course, that will be revealed in its full colours in the next part of the chapter, the lengths to which he will be prepared to go. But even here, of course, it's quite apparent the way in which we're told in verse 3 that he was troubled. As these Magi arrived in the city, he was troubled. Interestingly, by the way, we're told that all Jerusalem was troubled with him, which is perhaps Matthew hinting that even after Herod has disappeared from the scene, and he'll disappear from the scene fairly imminently, there will still be the spirit of Herod living on in Jerusalem and in the leaders of Jerusalem, and they will take up his mantle and they will oppose Jesus until finally they have got him nailed to a wooden cross. But Herod then is certainly being revealed here, being exposed. His heart is being exposed. That jealous possessiveness of his position. But once we've seen that, and once we've seen Herod revealed in that sense here in this passage, I think actually that reveals two further things. First of all, it reveals the beauty of Jesus. The beauty of Jesus. It's very interesting that Josephus, the first century Jewish historian, he refers to Herod by the very title that the Magi use here of Jesus, the King of the Jews. That was clearly a title that was used of Herod, the King of the Jews. And I think then Matthew is deliberately setting up a contrast here between the two kings of the Jews. It's interesting, isn't it, that he does refer to Herod as king. I mean, Herod's kind of kingship was something of a moot point. It was debatable to what extent he really was a king, and some people called him king and others didn't. But Matthew certainly does. Twice he calls him king here. And I think Matthew is deliberately then setting up this contrast between these two kings, between King Herod and King Jesus. And on the one hand then we have King Herod, who must retain his place, who must retain his position, who will go to any lengths necessary to retain his place and his position. And on the other hand we have King Jesus, who despite being, we discovered last time, God, remember Isaiah 7, God with us, despite being God himself, where is he now? He's in the little town of Bethlehem, a weak infant whose first bed was a manger. That's how unprotective he is of his position. He was willing to humble himself from the heights of glory and come down to ordinary little Bethlehem. Such a different spirit to Herod. Herod, who will kill anyone in order to retain his power. Jesus, who descends from heaven and obscures himself there in Bethlehem. It's interesting, too, that Matthew quotes here, doesn't he, from the prophet Micah. So this is Herod calling on his experts to discover exactly where the Messiah was going to be born, and so they read out from Micah. But what Matthew puts here is probably not exactly what those priests read out to Herod, because Matthew introduces a word change which is doubtless for the benefit of his readers. It's not what those priests would have said as they read this out in front of Herod, but Matthew introduces a word change, and it's the introduction of the word shepherd. That's not there in Micah. In Micah, he's just a ruler who will rule the people of Israel. Here, from you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel. And again, it's such a stark contrast with Herod, isn't it? That's precisely the sort of ruler that Herod isn't. He's no shepherd, he's a lion. He'll go and maul the babies of his own kingdom in Bethlehem, we'll discover next time. He's a vicious, ruthless, brutal leader who will throw his own subjects to the sword if necessary. Not Jesus. He's a shepherd leader. He's gentle. He's caring. He will lay down his life for the sheep. He won't take their lives. That's the sort of king he is. And so I'm saying then that, yes, it's grim to see Herod being exposed here for what he really is, but actually it only brings out more the beauty of Jesus. And there's a sense, isn't there, in which all earthly political leadership is at least a little tainted by the spirit of Herod. That's why Psalm 146 that we sang boldly told us, "Do not put your trust in princes." And it's why then we can, it's such a kind of liberating thing actually, isn't it, that we can read our newspapers and read of expense scandals in Westminster and sexual harassment scandals in Westminster. And yes, these things should grieve us, and we should be praying about such things because we have to pray for our leaders and so on, but they don't need to drive us to despair. Because at the end of the day, our fate is not in the hands of those leaders. We have another king, a shepherd king, a king who never has scandals, a king who never has feet of clay, a king who has nothing of Herod in him, but is the shepherd king who laid down his life for his subjects. It's a wonderfully liberating thing in a world of flawed leaders, isn't it? To be under the leadership of Jesus Christ. And so the beauty of Jesus comes out. But then the other thing revealed here is the condition of man. The condition of man. Because is there not a sense in which, in fact, Herod here represents all human beings? In the sense that he hates Jesus and rejects Jesus on the grounds that he's jealous for his own control and his own power and his own status. It's interesting, isn't it, that Herod is no skeptic. Herod believes the gospel all right. He believes the Old Testament all right. As soon as he finds out that there's going to be a Christ born in Bethlehem, he takes that seriously. He believes there's a Christ. He believes that Micah was an inspired prophet who spoke the truth hundreds of years earlier. He believes the whole thing. He takes it seriously. At an intellectual level, he has no objections whatsoever to the whole thing. Herod does not reject Jesus because it's incredible. He rejects Jesus because it's inconvenient. Because he wants to be his own boss and his own lord and his own king. And he doesn't like the idea of Jesus being a higher authority than him. And is it not the case that ultimately, with all rejection to Jesus, that's the underlying cause? And yes, many people will look like they are skeptical, and they don't believe what Micah said, and they don't believe what the Bible says, and they don't believe that Jesus is the Savior, and so on. But actually, if you could really get beneath that, the underlying thing is this. It's not they find it incredible. It's that they find it inconvenient. Perhaps that's where you are this morning. And you want to be in control of your life, and you don't want to hand over the reins to this Jesus. Well, let me say to you that yes, becoming a Christian does undoubtedly involve handing over your reins to the reins to this King Jesus. But he is the Shepherd King, and nobody who hands over the reins to King Jesus ever regrets that and finds him a harsh, tyrannical master. And as we share the gospel with people, we need to be aware of this, don't we? That however compelling and brilliant our intellectual arguments may be, that there's something beyond intellectual arguments that's stopping people coming to Jesus Christ. It's the will, there's a desire to retain control over their lives. And it's why then we must soak all our evangelism in prayer. Because only God can change that. We can win the arguments, only God can win the hearts. Only God can make a person see that this thing that looks so unattractive, becoming a captive of Jesus Christ, is in fact the route to true freedom and liberation. Only God can do that. And so let's indeed argue for the truth of the gospel, but let's do so in total dependence upon the God who alone can make people want Jesus Christ. And let's do so again, I say, remembering these are the last days in which we should expect people of all nations to be made by God to want Jesus Christ. The days of the Magi. May God encourage us. Amen.